I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point. Democrats control the House, the Senate, and the executive branch, and the United States government remains as divided as ever.
Our country's polarized right now. It's kind of shirts and skins, isn't it? And that makes it more difficult to find that common ground because elected officials aren't rewarded for that.
In an effort to help find common ground, Democrats are trying to revive earmarks, allowing members of Congress to direct federal spending to their home districts. But the practice is also marked by a history of corruption.
There is simply no doubt that the abuse of this practice has caused Americans to view it as a symbol of the waste and out-of-control spending.
Earmarks were eliminated in 2011, but in a phone call last week, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer reportedly told Democrats that the practice will return and that the effort will be bipartisan. Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut, another supporter of earmarks, is said to be, quote, working through the details of reformed process, end quote. That's according to a House Appropriations Committee spokesperson. A group of Republicans, led by Congressman Ted Budd of North Carolina and Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, have been pushing back, calling instead for the Earmark Elimination Act, which would permanently ban congressional earmarks. So this hour on Point, we'll talk about earmarks, the good, the bad, and whether they can be a solution to the gridlock in Congress. Joining us now is Jeffrey Lazarus. He's a professor of political science at Georgia State University. Jeff, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about the history of earmarks before we discuss why they are being brought back. They're as old as Congress, right?
Yes, that's correct. For as long as we've had congressional spending, we've had earmarks. The first spending bill in 1789 had an earmark for a lighthouse.
Wow. So what was the original purpose for these earmarks in Congress?
Well, the purpose for earmarks is to allow Congress members to direct spending to their districts for things that frankly, are politically expedient. No one is going to lie and tell you that the whole point of earmarks is to fund the things that are most socially beneficial. But hopefully along the way, the things which are politically benefit the members also help people in the district. So it's the idea is that it's sort of a win-win for both the members and the district.
So can you give us some examples or just sort of paint an idea, especially from history, about how earmarks generally worked, how they were seen as a beneficial thing? I mean, I think right now most of our listeners think of them as, you know, the swamp. So how did they already always have that kind of connotation?
Well, for most of American history, earmarks happened in secret. They weren't something that were publicized, at least not widely. The word earmark doesn't really enter American political discourse until maybe the late 90s. But your typical earmark is something that funds a local infrastructure project, like a road or a bridge, or a smaller thing like paying for new radio equipment for first responders. A lot of military spending gets directed through earmarks. So things like fixing up aging barracks at the local military base, or research funding for local universities. A big example of an earmark from my home state is the port of Savannah recently had to be dredged to allow for larger container ships, and that the money for that project was secured by an earmark.
Okay. So why is there a push now to bring these earmarks back? I mean, we have a very evenly divided Congress. There may be a lot of gridlock to come because of that. So why the proposal to bring back earmarks now?
I think the reason it's happening now is because Congress is so evenly divided. One of the effects that earmarks can have, not necessarily out in the country, but in Washington, is they can make it easier for congressional leaders to get their members in line to vote for bills. And right now, the Democratic majorities in both the House and especially in the Senate are so slim that any lost vote really could sink an important bill. One way that party and committee leaders get their members on board these bills is by throwing an earmark in there to give them a reason to vote for it.
I see. So it's a tool that's used by the party within the majority to help wrangle things in the majority. Wrangle support within the party for legislation. What types of legislation might we be seeing that play out?
You see earmarks in pretty much any really big bill. There's two types of earmarks, or you'll see earmarks in two types of bills. One is the regular spending bills that you see every year. Every year, Congress has to pass a set of spending bills in order to keep the government afloat. Those are called appropriations bills. Appropriations bills have the lion's share of earmarks. That's where most of them appear. But in addition to that, any regular bill that gets passed by Congress could contain an earmark. And those are the ones that usually get thrown in order to attract these members who are wavering and might not support the bill otherwise.
I see. So I'm just thinking off the top of my head, something like trying to muster more support for more progressive leaning legislation. Earmarks might be a way to bring more moderate Democrats on board, for example. Is that what you mean?
That's exactly what I mean. Historically, what you see is that these more moderate members are the ones who get a disproportionate share of earmarks precisely for that reason.
And when we talk about gridlock in Congress, it usually involves a partisan gridlock. Can these earmarks be used as a way to try to reach across the aisle?
In principle, yes. And historically, that has been something that earmarks have been used for. Unfortunately, I don't really see that happening today. Polarization is so strong and positions are so entrenched that I don't see a lot of members of Congress voting across the aisle just to secure a bit of spending for their districts. So I think in the modern era, mostly what you'll see earmarks get used for is to get moderate members of the majority party on board when the party's trying to pass a bill.
So is that why we are seeing this pushback, this planned pushback from folks like Senator Cruz by Republicans sort of throwing down the gauntlet here and saying they're going to try to stop Democrats from doing that?
That's one reason, is because Republicans are not in the majority, and so they're not going to benefit as much. But as well, you also see a pattern historically where fiscal conservatives are against earmarks generally. Earmarks are painted by them as wasteful spending, and as well, their voters just don't appreciate government spending in principle, right? You see Republican voters are the ones who are against big government and government support for a lot of projects. So Republican members in general don't see the same type of electoral benefit from earmarks as Democratic members do. And so that's the reason why you're seeing a lot of Republican members oppose the practice.
So we're going to talk a little later about some of the concerns and the potential for misusing earmarks. But I want to focus a little bit more for the rest of the segment about how earmarks can work when they've been utilized to really push forward big policies or social projects in districts that really benefited people. Can you give us some examples of those?
So, unfortunately, when you think about earmarks, the ones that always make the headlines are the ones that are, you know, easily painted as boondoggles. But in terms of socially beneficial earmarks, you know, there are all kinds of museums and parks and, you know, police departments and hospitals all across the country that have benefited from earmarks. One of the most high profile earmarks, in fact, is not a local project, but the New Horizons NASA mission that sent a probe to Pluto in 2015 was saved by an earmark. Early in the program's history, members of Congress wanted to eliminate the project to save the money. And Senator Barbara Mikulski saved the project by including an earmark in a spending bill.
Wow. Wow. And I'm just thinking now, you know, on Friday, we talked a lot about the situation in Texas, for example, or other places that might be experiencing some natural and not so natural disasters. I know emergency funding often follows with that. But with long term things like infrastructure, might earmarks be a way to help funnel more funding in places like that?
Absolutely. If I were a member of Congress from Texas, one of the things that I would be working on right now would be to try to secure an earmark in order to bolster my locality's electricity infrastructure. You know, obviously, there are needs in that area and members of Congress can fill them.
All right, we'll hold for right there just for a moment. We're discussing the history of earmarks and the recent push to bring them back. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're discussing the history of earmarks and the recent push to bring them back. And we're joined by Jeffrey Lazarus, professor of political science at Georgia State University. But before we go on, let's take a moment to look at a specific example of how earmarks were abused. We spoke with Marcus Stern, a retired journalist who in 2005 was investigating then-Congressman Randy Duke Cunningham. He says his reporting really picked up after he did what he calls a lifestyle audit.
I took a look at how he was living and I saw that he had purchased a $2.4 million house, which seemed way beyond his means because he was a member of Congress without any money otherwise. And his wife was an educator in public schools.
As it turned out, Duke Cunningham had sought millions of dollars in earmarks, and instead of spending that money on infrastructure or public education, he steered the funds to defense contractors he had relationships with, and he'd get a piece of the cake in return.
For instance, so this one item in 2004 was a $12 million purchase agreement with the Pentagon office to buy things for a counterintelligence office that was going to be set up in the wake of 9/11. And what they did, one thing they did with that purchase agreement was the defense contractor went out and bought a digital storage device for a couple hundred thousand dollars, then charged the government $6 million for it. And with that money, these contractors bought gifts for Cunningham.
Soon after Stern and his colleagues broke the news of Cunningham's corruption, the local U.S. Attorney's Office began to investigate him.
One of the key things was federal investigators went through the yacht that Cunningham was using that belonged to the contractor, and they left a piece of paper behind. And it was a piece of paper that became known as the bribe menu. and it showed, it was on Cunningham stationery, and it said, for $16 million in earmarks, I will get use of the boat, the yacht. And then for every $1 million after that, I'll get this amount of money. And once that piece of evidence was understood, it was all over, and Cunningham pled guilty to taking more than $2.4 million in bribes and accepting all of these lavish gifts.
That was retired journalist Marcus Stern. He was part of the Pulitzer Prize-winning team which broke the Randy Duke Cunningham story for the San Diego Union-Tribune. So, Jeff, the story of Randy Duke Cunningham is not unique to him. Can you walk us through some other examples of how earmarks have been used and abused by corruption?
Sure. Yeah, it really is unfortunate because the pattern with earmarks is a long one. You have another Southern California congressman named Daryl Issa, who owned a building and secured an earmark to improve a road that was located very close to his building in an effort to improve his building's resale value. You have the Bridge to Nowhere, which isn't an example of corruption, but an example of wasteful spending. So maybe I'll save that one for next one. Sorry about that. You have the story of the Meeks, Kendrick Meeks and his mother, who was also a former member of Congress, Congress member Meeks, secured an earmark from a for a local businessman who hired his mother and bought his mother a car. Perhaps the worst scandal of all of them was a member of Congress from Pennsylvania named John Murtha, who set up a very complicated pay-to-play system with a former staffer of his who became a lobbyist. And Murtha was chair of the House Appropriations Committee and essentially declared that if you wanted an earmark out of his office, you had to go through his former staffer, who would take a cut in a way that was similar to what was described in the Cunningham case.
Wow. So these are, and some of them are I know I remember these things happening. And we talked a little bit before about how some fiscal conservatives, Republicans, have always looked down on earmarks, been opposed to earmarks for policy reasons. But that list you just ticked off, the examples we just went through, that's a bipartisan list, right?
Very much. Corruption when it comes to earmarks knows no party bounds.
And so right now we're seeing this idea to bring back earmarks being floated by Democrats. If Republicans return to power, when they do, this goes back and forth, might we see the same thing being floated to Republicans if they see that as a tool to help get their own caucus in line?
You know, it's always possible. You know, the thing about earmarks is that they are really individualistic. You have a single member of Congress requesting an amount of spending for a single identifiable recipient. And so whenever you have that level of individuality, you're always opening up the door for possible bad actors to take advantage of the system. So, you know, anything is possible.
So I recently read a piece by Brian Bilbray, who replaced Randy Cunningham in Congress, and he wrote it after Randy Cunningham received a pardon from former President Trump. And one of the points that he made about what he did was that it eroded trust in the public. The people see this as the worst kind of Washington corruption. So is there a danger here, as lawmakers consider bringing earmarks back, that it could erode the public trust?
Yeah, it's always possible. And one of the reasons for that is that these scandals, these bad apples, are always going to be the ones that generate the most press. So when the public thinks of the word earmark, they're going to not think of the many hospitals or museums or roads or first responder units or what have you that get funded by earmarks, they're going to think of Duke Cunningham or John Murtha or Kendrick Meeks.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about how to guard against that. Is there a way to bring back earmarks, given that they are done, as you point out, in secret, but with enough protections in any measure to bring it back to prevent this kind of corruption from happening?
Well, no system is going to be foolproof, unfortunately, but there are some safeguards that you can put around the system that might help minimize the number and hopefully the severity of these types of scandals. One of these would be to forbid for-profit corporations from receiving earmarks. This is actually something that Democrats tried toward the end of the last earmarks era in 2010, but it wasn't enough to save the practice back then. Now, if earmarks do come back, that is almost certainly guaranteed to be one of the features of the new earmarking system, would be that earmarks would be reserved only for nonprofit organizations or local government organizations like cities and counties. So another safeguard would be to require a higher level of transparency than had been used in the past. So again, for many, many years, earmarks happened virtually in secret, as you mentioned. A member of Congress would speak to another member of Congress, and then all of a sudden, one line in a bill would appear on page 37 of a 400-page bill. One way to guard against corruption would be to bring some sunlight to that process. So you could require all members of Congress to publicly disclose all of the earmark requests. You could require members of Congress to publicly disclose all of the local recipients for people who are getting earmarks in their districts. Congress could provide a central clearinghouse for data on who is requesting and who is receiving these earmarks. This sunlight should help prevent, or at least make it harder for bad actors to use earmarks to enrich themselves.
When we hear these stories of corruption, it's important to note that they have consequences. In the case of Randy Duke Cunningham, he was sentenced to 8 years and 4 months in prison after pleading guilty.
The truth is I broke the law, concealed my conduct, and disgraced my office. I know that I will forfeit my freedom, my reputation, my worldly possessions, most importantly, the trust of my friends and family.
Marcus Stern, who we heard from earlier, says that while earmarks could help motivate Congress members to work together to pass legislation, he fears history might repeat itself.
If things don't go just right, there's going to be considerable pressure to figure out a way to monetize these earmarks again. And it's so easy to corrupt the system. It's just, as we saw in the 1990s, it can be abused. And, it was billions of dollars each year that was being abused through the earmark system. We could see that again.
I want to bring someone else into this conversation, William Galston. He is Ezra K. Zilka Chair and Senior Fellow of the Brookings Institution's Governance Studies Programs. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Kimberly.
So I want to get your reaction about the conversation we've been having. What are your takes about earmarks, how they can be both a vehicle for good, but also have the potential for corruption?
Well, I think that's a pretty good summary of earmarks, the classic double-edged sword. They can help build consensus around legislation, or they can encourage corruption. I think Professor Lazarus, guided by your questions, has offered a very complete roster of arguments against earmarks as well as for. But let me just Let me just summarize, because I think the indictment is a powerful one, won't necessarily lead to conviction, however. There's no question about the fact that earmarks can lead to wasteful projects. The famous Alaska Bridge to Nowhere is a classic example. It can lead to, you know, politics as transaction, where committee chairs and also private interests are in effect buying the votes of individual members of Congress. And even when that's legal, it doesn't smell good. As we've already heard in the case of John Murtha, it can enhance the power of committee chairs in ways that don't necessarily serve the public good. But then there are broader considerations here. I think very few Americans believe that if you add up all the private interests, you end up with the common good, even though that may be the case in some circumstances. And so the clip that you played, I believe, from Senator McConnell at the beginning of the program, I think is correct, that earmarks, when they are abused, are a symbol of waste that lead to a further loss of public trust, which is at historically low levels already. So that's the indictment. Guilty is charged? Not necessarily, because the other edge of earmarks for decades was the use of what are called member-directed projects to grease the legislative wheels. And there's no question about the fact that in the past decade, it has become harder and harder to legislate.
So I want to get to that point and also add the question about unnecessary spending bill. Is there a danger that reintroducing earmarks is going to start sending millions upon millions upon billions of dollars in spending that doesn't go through the normal transparent process that the public can see?
Well, there is that danger, but there are a couple of misapprehensions here that I think, you know, we ought to use this program to dispel. First of all, it is not the case that earmarks in the aggregate increase spending. They direct spending, and they divert funds from some uses to other uses within an overall total. The second misapprehension is that earmarks are a big portion of the federal budget. They aren't. They never were. They were even at their height, a tiny portion of the portion of the federal budget that goes through the appropriations process that Professor Lazarus mentioned earlier. But in today's media environment and climate of public mistrust, the examples of the abuse of the system dominate the airwaves and shape public consciousness about the overall system. I think that Professor Lazarus offered some useful reforms that might make the process more transparent and publicly accessible. Let me mention another one. Most people don't really focus on this because it's inside baseball, but there is a two-step process for getting money into particular uses and projects. The first stage is the authorization stage, where, you know, the authorizing committee or committees say Congress is allowed to spend money on this project. And in the second stage, the appropriation committee says this is how much we will spend for this authorized project. Problem is that in a lot of cases in the past, money was being appropriated without being previously authorized. And that was part of the non-transparency of the system. So a very important reform, it seems to me, would be to require the project to be authorized before it can be funded. That would make the process slow. It would slow it down, make it more transparent, make it less likely that corrupt or wasteful spending would get through the system.
I just want to pause just for a minute. Jeff, in the 30 seconds left in this program, do you think that might help eliminate corruption?
Actually, I do, because as I mentioned, one of the reasons or one of the things that allowed for corrupt earmarks was the extreme secrecy. And so requiring earmarks to be authorized would add another layer of transparency, another place for fact finders find these earmarks and help weed out these bad ones.
Okay, Jeffrey Lazarus is a professor of political science at Georgia State University. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
Bill, stay with us. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're discussing earmarks, the good, the bad, and whether they can be a solution to the gridlock in Congress. Joining us now is William Galston. He's Ezra K. Zilka Chair and Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute's Governance Studies Program. Bill, thanks for staying with us.
My pleasure.
So I want to get to that issue of using earmarks as a solution to partisan gridlock. Bill, I've been in Washington for almost 15 years now, and the one thing that has never changed is partisan gridlock. And, you know, that was even when earmarks existed for about half that time before they were eliminated in 2011. Do you think this could actually be a solution to bring the parties together?
It can make some difference, but I think you've underscored the crucial point, namely that the forces that have made for partisan gridlock are much broader and go much deeper than any one procedural reform in Congress could change. You've been in Washington for 15 years. I've been here for almost 40 years, and it wasn't always this way. There were periods during these 40 years of very fruitful legislation created and enacted with large bipartisan majorities. One classic example of this is the fundamental tax reform during the Reagan administration in 1986, if memory serves, and the people who crafted that legislation were on both sides of the aisle, and it took cooperation between a Republican president and a very Democratic Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill. So very deep forces since then have driven a wedge between the two political parties, and I wouldn't overestimate the ability of any one procedural change to close that gap. But at the margins, it can make a difference. There are lots of other ideas that are worth considering as well if the issue is not just moving legislation, but moving it forward on a bipartisan basis.
And I want to get to some of those ideas. But first, just one quick question about what you just said, how it hasn't always been this way. What is different about what's happening right now or what I've seen for the past decade or so than what happened before?
Well, where do I start? First of all,
I know in just a few seconds we have
right.
There used to answer this question.
There used to be a lot more overlap between the political parties. Parties have sorted out along ideological lines. I can remember when some Democrats were more conservative than some Republicans. You had liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats. You have very few of either left anymore. That's one difference. Another important difference is that elections have been nationalized, and representatives are seen by their constituents less as their local representatives and more in part as part of the national parties. I just read a study yesterday that out of the 435 congressional districts, there are only 16 that voted for a presidential candidate of one party and a congressional candidate of the other. Right, so that is a near complete nationalization that contributes to polarization. But those are two of the principal differences.
So talk about some of the ideas that you just mentioned moving forward that could help this work.
Well, you introduced me wearing one of my hats. Now let me put another one on for just a minute. A couple of years ago, I was one of the co-sponsors of a congressional task force on congressional reform, a task force of the American Political Science Association. We decided that Congress had become so dysfunctional that we should bring together 35 or 40 of the best congressional scholars in the country and let them deliberate for a year about packages of reforms that, among other things, might help create a more functional relationship between the two political parties. And they came up with a long list of reforms that would push in that direction. And I'll be happy just to list some, and we can discuss the ones that seem particularly interesting.
Sure, please do. Please do.
For example, the debt ceiling is a source of a great amount of partisanship, and there are ways of eliminating floor votes on the debt ceiling. There are ways of eliminating government shutdowns, so-called automatic continuing resolutions. We could change the procedures in both the House and the Senate to allow more amendments. Right now, in many cases, the minority party is completely shut out of the process. They're not allowed to offer amendments on the floor. And so they're presented with a series of take it or leave it propositions. And in those circumstances, they are sure to leave it, right? Because the bill was entirely drafted by the majority party. There are things that could be done to allow bills and amendments with bipartisan sponsorship, and there are some, to reach the floor of the House and the Senate more easily. And here's a really radical proposal. This was not part of the task force's recommendations, but I've been offering it in a variety of forums. Suppose the Speaker of the House were really the Speaker of the House and not simply the representative of the majority party. You could do that with a very simple device. Instead of electing the Speaker with 50% of the House plus one, you could require a 60% threshold. And because it's very rare these days that either political party gets to 60% control of the Congress, they would have to cooperate to pick a Speaker. And that process would probably lead to a more moderate Speaker who would try to make the House of Representatives as a whole a more functional institution and not simply serve as the boss of the majority.
Now, I know you you pose that as a more remote possibility in the current climate. How likely is it that any of these things might actually come to fruition with the current climate here in Washington?
Well, interestingly, a couple of years ago, at the beginning, not of this Congress, but the previous Congress, the 116th, a bipartisan caucus in the House of Representatives called the Problem Solvers, then made up of 25 Democrats and 25 Republicans, swore an oath that any candidate for Speaker of the House in January of 2019 would have to agree to some rules reforms that would make it easier to get legislation with bipartisan support considered by the House. And despite enormous pressure, they held firm, and someone who very much wanted to be Speaker again, namely Nancy Pelosi, ultimately came to this group and said, let's talk about which portions of our of your agenda I'll be able to accept. And they actually succeeded in creating some new opportunities for bipartisan legislation, not as much as they wanted, but a measurable step forward from what preceded it. So if you have groups that really care not just about passing legislation, but passing legislation with support across party lines, and if they are really determined to make change, they can.
Okay, I want to read a couple of comments from our listeners. One is from Stark Mojo. It says, I was against earmarks in principle, but seeing how badly things go without them, it may be something we have to do given the imperfect nature of human beings. And from Graves and Doyle, it says, earmarks must come back if Congress will ever work again. Maybe there can be limits to avoid abuses, but the only way. Otherwise, only politics control, and we have seen how that goes. I want to get your reaction to that.
I think those are two very wise comments. Let me focus particularly on the first, because the first contained a sentiment that James Madison would very much have agreed with, namely that we create institutions and practices with the imperfections of human nature firmly in mind. If you read the Federalist Papers, you will find that that is Madison's guiding principle. Yes, we need civic virtue, but you better not rely on it. You should rely on self-interest and ambitions as the dominant forces, particularly in politics. And then you should try to channel those through smart institutions and procedures to get as close as you can to the public good. It's the same sort of theory that Adam Smith talked about in Wealth of Nations, namely, it's not the public-spiritedness of the baker that you rely on to create loaves of bread that we eat. It is his desire to make a living. Now, that's not the only thing that guides bakers. Many of them are very proud of their product, but they do want to make a living and, if possible, improve their lot in life. So you're not counting on their generosity. And the same is really true in politics.
I want to talk a little bit more about the bigger picture about earmarks and how can they be a way to really drive policies from the bottom up instead of from the top down. Right now, we have seen how in Congress, the leaders really drive the policy directives in a real way. But if people need certain projects, if they want the officials that they elect in their districts to be responsive to them, aren't earmarks a way to sort of keep the policy closer to the ground?
In principle, yes, they can be. Now, in the past, unfortunately, they've been used as ways of enhancing the power of committee chairs. Professor Lazarus talked about John Murtha, for example, who famously used earmarks. I mean, he was the gatekeeper of the earmarks. And if you wanted to get an earmark, you needed to keep Mr. Murtha happy. Now, it's not always bad to have strong committee chairs, but it's not necessarily a way of legislating from the bottom up. And that's why I think processes that are much more transparent that give individual members opportunities to make their case that a particular project should be authorized, that can help devolve power from committee chairs down to the individual members who right now are extremely frustrated that they are required to act like potted palms. And whatever the majority leadership and the committee chairs tell them to do, they must do. That's not the way they want to spend their time. That's not why they worked so hard to get to Washington. But one more layer on top of this, and that is the age of strong committee chairs has been replaced to some extent by the age of strong party leadership, so that even the committee chairs now have lost a lot of their autonomy and are doing what the party leadership tells them needs to be done.
You are anticipating what I was talking about in terms of pushing forward this big legislative package on COVID-19 that is mm-hmm. being pushed from the top down. And one of the points that we brought up is about amendments. And Democrats are saying that amendments are a way that Republicans can participate in this. Republicans are saying this is a Democratic only piece of legislation. And you were saying that the amendment process is something that could be a reform. Can it really be?
Well, we shall see. What we know, that, and I just monitored this as of Friday. I'm not sure what's happened over the weekend. As of Friday, there had been more than, Republicans had offered more than 60 amendments. Not a single one of them has been accepted and incorporated into the legislation. That's not the end of the story, because the next question is how the COVID-19 bill will reach the floor. Let me explain very briefly. In the House of Representatives, before a bill can be considered on the floor, there needs to be a rule passed that determines how the bill will be treated on the floor, and including whether or not amendments will be allowed. And there's a so-called closed rule that says no amendments will be allowed, and it's going to be an up or down vote. We haven't yet seen the rule for the COVID-19 relief bill, but I suspect it'll be very close to a closed rule. And so Republicans will be presented with an up or down choice, and they will point thumbs down.
Yeah, Bill, we have about 30 seconds left. What do you predict we'll see going forward?
Well, one possibility is that the COVID-19 bill will be the model for the first 2 years of the Biden administration. The other possibility is that it will be an exception, and a president who ran on the issue of reunifying the country will use a process of bipartisan consultation to create more bipartisan legislation. We simply don't know. Mm.
And what about with the future of earmarks in 10 seconds?
If the Democratic leadership wants to restore them for the 117th Congress, which lasts 2 years, I suspect they'll be able to get their way, and then we'll see.
Bill Galston is Ezra K. Zilka Chair and Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution's Governance Studies Program. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I am Kimberly Atkins, and this is On Point.